The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Lori Townsend.
Hello, thanks for joining us for the first show for Alaska Edition of 2015. It's our inaugural program for this new year, but we'll be talking in part today about the last days of the Office of the Federal Coordinator for an Alaska North Slope Natural Gas Pipeline. Larry Pursley is my guest today. Welcome, Larry.
Welcome. I've always wanted to go to an inaugural.
And here you are.
It's my first one.
Well, thanks for being here. Larry has been at the helm of the coordinator's office since being appointed by the president in 2010. And I was being a little dramatic about the final days, but it is the final days.
Right.
Before we discuss the impending demise of the pipeline coordination office, give us a brief rundown of how and why the federal position was created.
Sure. Real briefly, back in 2004, before shale gas, before the industry had figured out hydraulic fracturing, horizontal drilling, and producing shale gas, it looked like North America, particularly the United States, was going to run short of natural gas. So Congress looked at it and said, we've got to get an Alaska natural gas pipeline built to bring North Slope gas down to the lower 48 so we don't go cold. So Congress passed legislation, the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act of 2004, that set up an office to coordinate permitting, to make sure the environmental review went as quickly as possible, to limit judicial review. There were some loan guarantees, some tax credits. It was a national interest finding that the time has come for this project. This office will help.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't quite go that way.
It did not quite go that way. Alaskans are, of course, very interested in this development of a natural gas line, especially in light of declining oil and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Development and bringing to market the vast stores of gas on the North Slope would, of course, bring a new revenue stream to Alaska, but it's also seen as a way to spur new oil exploration and development. Explain that.
It is. You know, you're looking at a $40, $50, $60 billion project for the Alaska LNG project, which we're looking at currently. The companies, if they put that kind of money into the North Slope, this project is going to produce gas for 30, 40, 50 years. You produce gas on the North Slope as you produce oil. It comes up together at Prudhoe Bay. We've been re-injecting the gas ever since Prudhoe started. Now, if this project goes ahead, they would start diverting some of that gas into the pipeline, to the liquefaction plant. But you still got to be producing oil up there to get the gas. So a commitment to this project, I think, would do more than anything to guarantee that oil operations on the North Slope would continue for decades longer. Mm-hmm. And oil is not today. Oil normally is where the big money is. Prices will go up eventually.
There's been two proposals, a smaller diameter all-Alaska line and a large diameter line for shipping gas to Asia. Given the slumping prices of oil, we've lost about 50% of the value in this last year. Does it make sense to consider, continuing to consider, two lines?
Well, I guess Governor Walker would say, and has said this past week, no, it doesn't make sense. He's been very clear about that. But the history of it, Alaskans have been waiting for 40 years for a natural gas pipeline. You found oil and gas at Prudhoe Bay in 1968. By 1977, oil was moving down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and Alaskans have been grumpy ever since then that the gas line wasn't built. You know, I think they thought at the beginning you'd build the oil line, take the weekend off, turn the backhoe around, go the other direction, and build a gas line. So years of frustration, even though it never made sense to build a natural gas pipeline project until recently. So as the companies in the past several years have ramped up their look at a large volume, large diameter, large cost natural gas pipeline, there have been Alaskans who say, oh, it's not going to happen. I'm tired of hearing it. They're not going to do it. That's just, it's another false start. So a few years ago, the legislature looked at it and said, we have to have a backup plan in case the large volume, large diameter, large cost producer-led project doesn't go ahead. The state will have a backup plan ready, and that is the smaller volume, smaller diameter pipeline, but still expensive, somewhere between $6 and $10 billion, and those are old construction estimates. That smaller line would take care of in-state need, but would not be tied to an export project. So Some would say that's a backup plan. The legislature appropriated about $420 some million and said, get your permits, do your right-of-way, do your planning, and then have it ready in case we need it. There are others who look at it and say, that should not be the backup. That should be the main plan because the big one won't go ahead. So there's some conflict there. There are others who say, hey, even if the big plan doesn't go ahead, that smaller one just isn't economically viable. And the economics on it are very challenging. Alaska just is not a very big market. You wouldn't sell enough gas just within Alaska to pay off that $6 or $8, $10 billion mortgage. But the governor, like I say, this past week has changed the discussion on that. But the plan was back up, don't build two, one or the other, or unfortunately, maybe neither is also a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, staying on that idea of it not penciling out as far as a smaller diameter line, I think that there's been some confusion about that with some Alaskans saying, well, we've got the money in reserves. Of course, that conversation has changed now with the dramatic drop in oil prices. But there was a call at one time for, let's just build this line ourselves, and we've got the money. Why worry about someone else helping us? We can build this line. But as you said, the population numbers, it just wouldn't work. Is there a possibility of a smaller diameter line that could serve Alaskans, but also export some?
Right. If you build a smaller diameter line, if the big project doesn't go ahead, and if the state legislature, governor, public decide as a matter of public policy, future economic development, they want to build that small line with state money, you're going to have to get more customers than just topping off the tank in South Central, than picking up Fairbanks, which is a small customer when you look at an $8 billion project. You could feed into the existing ConocoPhillips Nikiski LNG plant. But there again, just because you can send gas to the Nikiski plant, if you can't do it at a price that's competitive, no one overseas is going to buy it. And because you don't have economies of scale, because it's a smaller project, the delivered cost of North Slope gas to the Nikiski plant, the Conoco plant, to Agrium, the fertilizer plant that has been closed for several years on Kenai, if you cannot deliver it at a low enough price, those are not economic, so you may or may not have customers there. The idea behind the small line was do all the work and then go out there and basically go to bid and say, I want to build this. Here's how much it's going to cost you to use it. Does anybody want to sign a contract to use it? And that's been postponed going out for those bids. It's called an open season, but that would be the economic test of whether or not it could work.
Mm-hmm. Given the prices that we're seeing right now, does it make sense? We're at or below $50 per barrel for oil right now. Can the state still afford to be a partial owner of a gas line? And should the state do that?
Okay, and you're talking about back to the bigger project.
Yes, back to the bigger project.
And let me just one other point on the smaller one. If it came to that, you're right. The state could take money out of savings if there's any savings left. It could take money out of the permanent fund. If you don't have a mortgage to pay off the project, can move gas pretty cheaply. But if you don't want to write a check out of the permanent fund, you're going to have to borrow money, which means you have to make enough profit on it to pay back the mortgage. Getting to your last question, though, the state, as envisioned by the Parnell administration and sanctioned by the legislature last year in Senate Bill 138, I believe, the state would be a 25% owner in the liquefaction plant, marine terminal, shipping terminal down at Nikiski. 25% of that, I'm going to guess, is roughly $6 billion, give or take. I'm not privy to the confidential numbers, but that seems a good ballpark guess. So you could borrow a lot of that if you have contracts to sell your gas, but you're still going to have to come up with your down payment. Nobody loans 100% on a project like this. So the question is, if construction goes ahead, if the project goes ahead, and if 2018, 2019, 2020, during construction, the state has to come up with 20-30% down of $6 billion, where are you going to get it?
Mm-hmm.
Depends on oil prices, but it's even the state revenue commissioner in testimony last year said, hey, people, I know you want to own part of it, but you got to be able to afford to own part of it. So let's think about this. You know, because you don't want to go so much in debt that you jeopardize the state's bond ratings. You don't want to spend down your savings so low that you don't have a cushion. And nobody is saying, oh, just write a check out of the permanent fund. So finding the money to be an owner, particularly with low oil prices, particularly with declining declining savings, is going to be challenging.
What about Point Thompson? How big a part of this being successful, this idea of a gas line being successful and more oil in the Trans-Alaska pipeline, how big a component of it is Point Thompson?
Point Thompson is mostly a gas field, not a liquids field. Point Thompson is essential to this project. Point Thompson has more than one quarter of the proven natural gas reserves on the North Slope. If you didn't have Point Thompson, I don't think you'd be looking at such a big project, because just the gas at Prudhoe Bay is not going to keep that pipeline full enough to pay off, long enough to pay off the mortgage. You need that Point Thompson gas. So having Point Thompson developed is essential to the project. It also produces liquids, which would go through its own pipeline into Prudhoe Bay and into the Trans-Alaska pipeline, which is great. We need more liquids through the line so it keeps moving and doesn't freeze over solid on us.
Mm-hmm. This week, Governor Bill Walker fired three of the board members of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. What's your read on this action?
So the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, AGDC, has two jobs. They represent the state for the state's seat at the table as the 25% owner of the proposed liquefaction project as part of the producer-led Alaska LNG venture. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation also, in its original purpose, was to develop the smaller volume, state-financed, state-supported gas line as the backup plan. And the governor said, hey, I want to change here. He said he wants a paradigm shift in the state's approach to gas development. He said he wanted to decentralize. Instead of having everyone just from Anchorage and the rail belt, he wants to bring in Alaskans on the board who don't necessarily live in the area that would be served by the gas line, because this is Alaska Gas, should serve everyone. The board members are not the ones who are going to negotiate contracts. That would be staff. They're not the ones who are going to build it. They shouldn't micromanage the project. They will set broad policies, as any board of directors would. So replacing the board in itself, I don't think hurts, as long as you get good board members in there as a replacement and they have a positive direction forward. If new board members are put there to disrupt things, which I don't think is the governor's plan, that would be a problem. But I think replacing the board is more of a controversial, political controversy, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Replacing the board in and of itself doesn't jeopardize the project. Replacing board members started a political firestorm with some members of the legislature who are now very upset with the governor. You might see repercussions of that when the governor comes to the legislature and says, hey, I want to take Medicaid, expand Medicaid, I need your vote. Well, governor, I'm kind of mad at you about sacking the board members on Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. I'm not sure I'm with you on Medicaid. I think that'll be interesting to watch those politics, but replacing the board members, again, doesn't hurt the project unless new board members come in with some very different set of ideas.
Mm-hmm. What about the concern over the confidentiality agreements that were requested by the producers? Companies frequently want those kind of things to protect proprietary information. A good example is seismic testing. A lot of times they want to keep that information, and that's understandable. They're figuring out what's available and keeping that competitive edge. But in this setting, there's not other companies clamoring to build a line, so does it make sense for them to ask for this confidentiality agreement?
It makes sense, and it's not a matter of someone else trying to build it. It's a matter of an extremely competitive global market for natural gas. This project is going to live or die on whether or not the state of Alaska, BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon can get customers in Japan and Taiwan and China and India and South Korea and Indonesia and who knows where else, get customers to sign binding 15 or 20-year contracts to buy the LNG out of Nikiski. there are projects in Australia and Papua New Guinea and Russia and the Middle East and the U.S. Gulf Coast and British Columbia and Tanzania and Mozambique. They're all trying to sell LNG to those customers. So you don't want, in that environment, anyone else to know what your engineering ideas are, how you're trying to sort of fine-tune to bring your cost down, what your schedule is, what kind of technology you're using. You can't.
So
you're going to lose a competitive edge.
Does it seem reasonable to you then that they are asking for these?
It seems entirely reasonable. When Fred Meyer comes into town and negotiates for land purchase, they don't do it publicly. It's businesses, and this is a business venture. Alaskans have to understand that, yes, the state may own the subsurface rights, so we signed a lease, someone's going to produce the gas on our behalf, give us our royalty share and pay taxes. But this $50 billion project is a private business venture. And private businesses, when Boeing sells some jets to Alaska Airlines, they don't tell all their other customers what the terms are. It's just the way business is. So last year during the legislative session, when the discussion was, should the state become a 25% owner in this, there was a lot of talk about the inherent conflict of the state of Alaska, a public entity with the public right to know, now being a partner in a private business venture, and the conflict you would have between public and private. This is very unusual. Mm-hmm. Nothing like it in this country. I think this is an example. Now, you're going to have to find a way to deal with this for this project to go forward.
Mm-hmm. In that same light, the governor has instructed his commissioners, Labor and Commerce, who are on the board, not to sign confidentiality agreements. What are the implications of that? Is that a potential for mucking up the works and slowing things down?
And my understanding, he's also told his revenue commissioner and natural resources commissioner. He has said, I do not want my cabinet members signing confidentiality agreements. And the governor has said he won't sign it. Yet the deputy commissioner of natural resources, Marty Rutherford, who will be head of this gas line negotiations, she will sign the confidentiality agreement. So it's going to be interesting. You're going to have a deputy commissioner of natural resources sign confidentiality. She'll lead the negotiations with Alaska LNG partners on this private business venture. But then when it comes time for her to brief the commissioners and the governor, she's going to say, well, I can brief you, but there's some things I can't tell you. This is going to be an interesting set of dynamics. How does this play out? It seems kind of awkward to me. Whether the two commissioners who are on the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation board, if they haven't signed the confidentiality agreement, then they're going to have to leave the room sometimes. But again, I don't think the issue here isn't going to be, I don't think, whether the commissioners sign it. The controlling authority is the governor. What is his attitude? What does he mean by paradigm shift in how the state deals with it? That's going to be the deciding factor. The fact whether the labor commissioner really knows the private confidential deals probably doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Beyond that concern, there's been a lot of other factors that could impact the development of a gas line, the shale oil and gas boom, fracking boom in the lower 48 is part of the reason that oil prices have dropped as low as they have. OPEC has said they're not going to slow down their production, and that will certainly, and already is, impacting some of the lower 48 producers. They're slowing down projects. Mm-hmm. People will be laid off. How will that, there's a pushback against fracking. New York has banned fracking. They did that just last month. Environmentalists are targeting California now as the next place that they want to see banning fracking.
There's a town in Texas that banned hydraulic fracturing.
How will that impact the possibility of a gas line here? Does that sort of, as development slows down there, will that help push the gas line forward?
Well, getting back to our office, so in 2004, Congress said North America needs Alaska gas. Let's go ahead with this office and this legislation. And then fracking came along, and now North America has way more gas than it needs, so much so that you have multiple companies lining up to export lower 48 natural gas from proposed projects in Texas and Louisiana and Maryland and Oregon and Mississippi and Georgia. I guess you could tell yourself, well, if the environmentalists shut down fracking so much in Lower 48 that Lower 48 runs out of gas again, they're going to need Alaska gas, and we'll go back to building a line from Alaska through Canada into Montana. I don't expect that to happen. So I don't think it's going to change the direction of this project. In terms of competing with Alaska LNG in overseas markets, I don't think the opposition to fracking is going to make a difference, because it's not just Alaska versus the U.S. Gulf Coast. Alaska's competing against the U.S. Gulf Coast, but really, Qatar in the Middle East, Australia, Indonesia is an exporter. Tanzania and Mozambique, they have found offshore four times as much gas as we have at Prudhoe Bay. So the Lower 48 just isn't the biggest competitor out there to Alaska LNG. So if there are problems with environmental opposition to fracking and cost problems in Lower 48, that's not going to be the determining factor whether this project gets built. If opposition to fracking or environmental problems with fracking, and there are some, mm-hmm. if they reduce the production of natural gas in the Lower 48, that just means there'll be less of it to export from Texas and Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, but that doesn't mean the market is now at our beck and call. We will have other competitors.
Let's get back to the fact that the Office of the Federal, your job, is going right. away. How will the closure of this office impact the progress on a gas line?
So what happened is the law said, go work on a North American project. Congress never changed the law, and the administration said, well, if you don't change the law, you can't work on an export project. You don't have legal authority. So we were not in the budget for this year, and Congress didn't change that, so we weren't funded. We do have some leftover money, which we're using. We will be closing down the Alaska office and a small office in Washington sometime February 28th, March 1st, give or take a few days. A lot of what we've been doing the last few years is trying to get information out to the public about this project, about federal permitting, federal export laws, what's going on around the world with LNG markets. And I am talking with other administration officials about, even though this office wasn't funded, public information is still a job of government. Let's see if we can find some other place in the federal government to put some of this information service, the website, the databases we've built up, so we could continue that. And hopefully within the next month, I'll know if we're successful in that.
Senator Murkowski is now the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Any chance that there could be some 11th hour funding effort? Have you talked to her about that to keep the office going?
Talk to her staff. Congress is not as nimble as the state legislature. Yes, the state legislature often does supplemental budgets on short notice at the start of a session if the firefighting fund comes up short or something else. And Congress just isn't that nimble. You've got 534 colleagues of Senator Murkowski, and to get everyone to agree for essentially what would be an Alaska earmark, which are not real popular. Earmarks are bad. Alaska earmarks are even worse to the 534 colleagues. There's not going to be any last-minute savior coming in the next 30 days for the office. So we're giving away furniture to other federal agencies, so at least there's good life after us.
And you did mention that you'll try to find a way to transition
right.
some of the work that's being done. How will that be carried out beyond just this idea of housing the website somewhere else? Where will people go to get these coordinated efforts?
It would depend if I can get another agency to take it over, what kind of funding we can scrape together. But at a minimum, I think it's important to continue the website, the reports, where the office has been able to explain to people how an environmental impact statement works for such a huge project. What's the timeline? How do you get involved? What's some of the history? So that's what I'm looking for. And also keep federal agencies involved, because even though certainly Bureau of Land Management and EPA and National Marine Fisheries have their own role in this project, it helps other federal agencies to know what everyone else is doing to coordinate it. So I'm working with others in the government to see if we can figure a way out to continue that.
The current cost estimates for building a large diameter line sit at somewhere between $45 and $65 billion,
correct.
Which is quite a spread.
Right.
How does that change with each passing year? Is there a way to determine that?
Well, that's a lot of what they're doing now. Those are $2,012, dollars, the 45 to 65, and for people who wonder, it's not just the pipeline. In fact, pipeline is not the single biggest component. That 45 to 65 includes some field costs that you would have, particularly at Point Thompson, to start producing the gas. The pipeline from Point Thompson into Prudhoe Bay, which is about 60 miles, the 800-mile pipeline down to Nikiski and the compressor stations, the liquefaction terminal, storage tanks, marine docks. The liquefaction plant's the largest single item in that 45 to 65, probably half of it. What the companies are doing now, a lot of what they're doing is working that estimate to come up with not a widespread, but a pretty good estimate at the lower range, hopefully.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Larry. Thanks to my guest, Larry Pursley, for being here with us today. And thank you for watching Alaska Edition. We'll be back next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.